I still remember like it was yesterday. I was in Florida for a church planters conference, which is a gathering for pastors who are just self-deceived enough and maybe brain-damaged enough to think, yes, Lord, maybe I actually could start a brand new church from the ground up. And so there I sat, no more than a year or so into this crazy ride, and I'm surrounded by a bunch of other planters who had also been trying really, really hard to do what all of us had at one point in time felt called by God to do. But as I looked around the room, I saw mostly sad faces propped up by mostly slumping shoulders. And it was obvious what every last one of us needed, what everyone longed for, the takeaway we had come hoping we would receive, was a message from God that would lift our spirits with a faith-stretching infusion of new hope. And we got it in the person of a well-known pastor. In fact, if I said his name, you'd probably recognize it. A pastor who had started his church almost 25 years before. He strode out onto the platform, scanned the room filled with hopeful but slump-shouldered leaders, and this is what he said. What you are doing, pastors, isn't wrong. It's just hard. Just very, very hard. Sometime after that, a pastor friend invited me to lunch, and at one point in the meal, he said, Wyatt, I just feel like I'm supposed to tell you, you, without any doubt, are the one person on this planet who could make that church thrive given all the obstacles you've had to face. Now, he and I have been friends for 30 years, so I wasn't sure if he was complimenting my skills or taking a shot at my stubbornness. But either way, the point hit home. It takes tenacity to be a leader, because leadership is hard. It's just very, very hard. Now, if you are also a leader, and I'm talking about leadership in any realm, because if you're a teacher, you're a leader. If you're a parent, you're a leader. If you're a business owner, a little league coach, a shift manager, a vocal instructor, a volunteer coordinator, mark it down. If you're the one responsible for getting it done, you're a leader. And if you are, and I would suspect that at one level or another we all are, then a huge slice of your leadership role is this. You're the one who sets the vision for why your organization does whatever it is that you do, and also how you plan to actually do it. But leader, it is also your task to communicate that vision, even to the point of over-communicating the vision. Hang on, you're not done, because if you don't also establish some fixed guardrails that keep your organization focused in the execution of your vision will likely never become a reality. Now, in most organizations, leadership isn't just a singular job. If anything, it's an amalgamation. You talk to any leader, and if they're honest with you, most leaders feel that they have so many roles and so many tasks and wear so many hats. This is how they feel about their role. Plus, they have to oversee various departments as well as the organization as a whole because it's screaming for your attention. And sometimes as a leader, you feel like you do everything from change the paper towels in the men's room to populating spreadsheets for the deferred maintenance you know is coming down next year, even though you don't know how you're going to do this year's budget. And yet, the one duty no leader can ever, ever delegate is casting, communicating, and then guarding your organization's vision. Now, in this story that we've been telling about Nehemiah, this incredible man of God, this unlikely hero, unlikelier leader who had been called by God to rebuild the great wall that once protected mighty holy city of Jerusalem, this man who wore way too many hats, even though he also had precious little time, we've been tracking him. And in chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 10, Nehemiah has been wearing the hat of cupbearer to the king, remember? But starting today and then all the way through chapter 6, Nehemiah starts wearing a different hat, one that he probably felt the least qualified to wear, yet he's the leader, so he's wearing it, which is why I find his story so inspiring. But then in the latter part of his story, Nehemiah has to reach for a third hat when he gets tapped out to serve as Judah's first governor under his old boss, King Artaxerxes. But somewhere in between his role as cupbearer and then his assignment as construction supervisor, Nehemiah had to wear yet another hat, one that a lot of leaders still have to wear today. And since he was, in fact, the leader of this whole project, Nehemiah had to wear the hat of chief vision caster, which to me is one of the most difficult leadership challenges there is, because leaders have to find a way to make vision stick, even though vision never seems to have enough adhesive. Have you noticed? It's uncanny, but no matter how clearly I think I've unpacked a vision for my team, and in spite of my efforts to keep repeating that vision, inevitably someone will make a comment that makes me wonder, where have you been? Are you not paying any attention at all? But that's how vision is. In my experience, there are three primary obstacles to making vision stick: success, failure, and everything else. I'm serious. There's never a season when a leader can just push autopilot and expect the organization to keep chugging in alignment with the vision. Because trust me, it won't. Meanwhile, if your vision is communicated both properly and regularly, it will help everybody on your team know why you do some things and why you don't do other things. It focuses attention on what matters and diffuses needless controversies that swirl about what it is that matters less. For example, today we are putting on a car show. Did you notice? And we're doing it because our vision is to lead people to follow Jesus. That is why this church exists. And by the way, Paul had that same vision for his life, even to the point of giving us a clue about how vision shapes around a person's life. Because he said, I become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. So I'm thinking putting on a car show fits. And yet, I don't want you to raise your hands, but how many of you kind of grumbled when you had to walk twice as far as you normally walk? Past a bunch of stupid car people who got the prime spots for a party that's breaking out on the Lord's Day. Well, the vision explains why. Because if we follow Jesus, if we exist, if our primary reason for breathing is to lead people to follow Jesus, even car people, then makes sense. And if Paul is right, and he is, when he says that we who already follow, we must be willing to be happily inconvenienced if it means in the process that we're leading more people to follow, even if they are car people. Is anybody following where I'm trying to take you? I mean, why wouldn't we, by every means at our disposal, seek to provide irresistible environments and to create inviting platforms from which we can step into moments and seek to meet needs in our community in the name of and with the love of Jesus? Now, if we only do these things to be more esteemed by our community, or if our ultimate goal is to get to sit at the cool kids' table at lunchtime, then no, car shows are a waste. But if we seek to use every tool in our toolbox as a way to lead people to follow Jesus, then we must use every tool we can get our hands on. Just understand, if you happen to be the keeper of that vision, there will always be a lot of stuff working against you. Now, check that. Everything will work against you. Success, failure, the passage of time, this little detail we call a life. such things get in the way, right? But if in spite of all those distractions, if there's something inside you that refuses to give up and that simply will not settle for the status quo, but instead you're driven by something you see that could be, and with God's help maybe it should be, then you may very well be the person God has tapped out to bring about great change. I have a preacher friend whose church had just built a beautiful new facility, and they built it because their vision was to use that facility as a way to reach hundreds more people for Christ. On the Sunday when they dedicated the new building, a rather cranky elder walked up to my friend and said, "Pastor, I hope this goes well. Just know this church is just two bad sermons away from disaster." Well, thank you for that. Now, 20 years later, that church is still thriving, and my pastor friend, who left a lucrative career and leveraged his financial security because he couldn't get that vision out of his head, because it was a vision God had planted in his heart, just saying, I think my friend is a lot like Nehemiah. Because Nehemiah, after he finally got permission from the king to go back to Jerusalem, and in spite of immediate opposition, remember, from Sanballat and Tobiah, who tried to keep him from going, Nehemiah finally, unbelievably, against all odds and in the face of so many obstacles, he did. He went to Jerusalem. The king set him free, meaning the pace was picking up. Things were beginning to happen. The vision was actually launching. And in practically no time, Nehemiah and his entourage are on their way to the king's forest to cut timber for those brand new city gates. Once that task was accomplished, they began to make their way slowly, you've got to remember, to Jerusalem, a journey of about 1,000 miles. Now, Nehemiah had no clue what he was going to find when he got there. He just knew what God had put on his heart to do. But he also knew that without the support of the people of Jerusalem, success was impossible. So once again, his vision comes crashing into the cold, hard reality that this project he had dreamed for and dreamed about and sacrificed so much to see happen, it could still get shut down. But then there was that morning on the farthest horizon when he caught his first glimpse of Jerusalem. Can you imagine the emotions? The great, majestic city looming larger and larger in his windshield. This man who had never even seen the holy city of Jerusalem, but he had wept over Jerusalem. He sees her now. And you got to believe that he wept again as his entourage made their final approach. And you got to also believe that the whole city was stirred when he got there. Because it wasn't every day that a Persian official would ride into town flanked by armed bodyguards. Plus, what is he going to do with all this lumber? Just saying, chances are good that news of his arrival was all over town well before the last horseman passed through what was left of Jerusalem's gate. I mean, who are these people? And why are they here? You can be sure that nobody in Jerusalem knew. And Nehemiah, he wasn't telling. Verse 12 says, he had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. Wow, can I make a confession? When I got what I think is a good idea, I can't keep my mouth shut for 3 minutes. But Nehemiah doesn't do anything or say anything for 3 days. Doesn't pull out a trowel or hire subcontractors or hang a plumb line from what remained of the wall. Neither did he call a meeting with the city planning commission because he knew it was too early to start announcing his intentions. So instead, Nehemiah spent those first 3 days and nights taking inventory of just how bad it was. Look at this. I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. But by night, I went out through the valley gate toward the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on toward the fountain gate and the king's pool. But that area was such a mess, there wasn't enough room for my mount to get through. So Nehemiah got off his mount and went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Now, I want you to note two things about that. Twice, he talks about examining, inspecting, and thoroughly assessing the damage. He made a careful, probing examination because as the leader, he had to be aware of what it was going to take to get the job done. And only then did he turn back, you see it, and re-enter through the valley gate. This is as good a time as any, I suppose, to say that there's a huge difference between being informed about the details and getting lost in detail. And the individual who's able to step back, make a full, robust assessment, fully informed, and yet not so overwhelmed by all the minutiae, that's the person who is best equipped to lead. Nehemiah added, the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would eventually be doing the work. I find that incredible. Folks, that's an aspect of leadership that very few people ever get to see. Most people have this false romantic notion that a leader's life is nonstop excitement, that he's constantly basking in the limelight, enjoying one ecstatic round of adulation after another. But check it out. Nehemiah spent all that time all by his lonesome walking before he ever opened his mouth and started talking. He didn't prance into town, hold a press conference, and announce his plans to change with loud fanfare and a marching band to boot. No, he did some very quiet, behind-the-scenes fact-finding, because he knew, as you got to know, he must have been excited, yet he knew he had to keep a level head. Just say to you, if God has put something on your heart to do, do it like Nehemiah. At first, don't tell anybody. For one thing, I've found out nobody is ever going to be as excited about your vision as you are. Anybody notice that? And their lack of zeal has the potential of shutting you down even before you get started. To share your vision prematurely almost always guarantees a less than cordial response. Besides, there will always be loads of background work that just has to get done before you really ought to take your dream public. There's fact-finding, there's exploratories, there's research and homework before you ever start telling anybody what you're up to. By the way, did you know Jesus taught this same principle? He asked his disciples one time, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? In other words, know what you're up against first and what you may be leading other people to go up against as well. And that's why Nehemiah took the time to get boots on the ground assessment. It's not that he was having second thoughts. He wasn't scanning the debris, trying to make up his mind, am I really going to do this or not? No, he did the assessment because he was already committed. But then when he finally did open his mouth, he knew what they were up against. See, when the time comes for you to announce your vision, and you open up that tiny little baby-sized vision, you open that vision up for way more than just discussion. You also expose it to criticism, right? Because everybody that you share it with is going to want to know one thing. How? How are you going to do it? Because that's huge. So what is your plan, Nehemiah, for how? And if you haven't taken the time to investigate the how, you run the risk of allowing just one negative personality to squash the whole deal. Okay, let's keep the doggy moving, because Nehemiah, having done his homework, having completed the assessment, is ready to get this puppy moving. He hadn't said a word for 3 days, but now that he has a handle on it, he stands up before the city council and he says, "You see the trouble we are in? Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. So come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace." And by the way, if you have a paper Bible, you might want to do this or mark it later in your iPad. In verse 17, I find three key words. We, us, and we. For Nehemiah to adequately motivate the city planning commission, his potential employees, and all those hundreds of volunteers, he had to personally identify himself with the need. Can you imagine the response if he had opened up his proposal saying, "Well, you Jerusalemites have blown it. Look at what you have done to this place. Come on, get up, get with it. Get this wall redone. I did my part. I got the wood. If you need anything else, I'll be binge watching something over at my new house we just built. But this one's on you. You caused a mess." Casting blame and offering nothing but criticism always, always squelches motivation, and it brings the whole project to a screeching halt. But when the leader identifies with the problem, rolls up his own sleeves, and gets his own fingernails dirty, just doing that will encourage his people that the thing that needs done can actually get done. And I want to show you, primarily from verse 17, how he got it done. Nehemiah started by painting a compellingly simple vision. Wasn't a pretty vision. Jerusalem, Nehemiah said, you see it, was in trouble. Because it lay in ruins and its gates had been burned with fire. But then he started painting a vision picture that God had given him 800 miles away back in Persia. A compelling portrait of what Jerusalem could be. A portrait fueled all these months now by Nehemiah's conviction that it simply had to be. We did a similar thing when we launched this church nearly 12 years ago. My vision was to start a church that offered real hope for real people. Even if in doing so, it meant in the process we might get our hands dirty, we wanted to be the kind of church where God could take muddy people and shape them into beautiful masterpieces. And that was my passion. And it was my passion because about 18 years ago, I experienced a season of breathtakingly awful pain, primarily at the hands of Christian people. It wasn't God who did it. God never did turn his back on me, and there never was a time when I didn't feel his amazing love for me. But other believers, people that I knew had stink on them too, they were vicious. And I remember often praying to God and just saying, "Lord, I love you. I do. I still love you. Always have, always will. But Lord, your kids, some of your kids are whacked out. But Lord, if you really do want me to start a church and be a pastor again, then it's going to have to be a real message loaded up with real hope for really messy people." Now, if you're theologically well-heeled, you will immediately want to poke holes in a vision like that and raise your hands to get all kinds of clarifying questions. Because your theology likes it when stuff has answers and you can file it all appropriately. And real hope for real people, I'm sorry, there's no mention of the cross there. Or salvation through the blood of Jesus there. So at best, Pastor, isn't real hope for real people kind of incomplete? Well, we fielded those questions and decided to go ahead with it anyway. And if somebody had questions, we'd talk because we were more than willing to address whatever concerns people had. Because this church, if anything, has always been solid at the core. Really has. But if you weren't into all that theological mumbo-jumbo, and if all you really wanted to know is whether a church really could care for messed up people, I'm just saying real hope for real people pretty much said it. It said to people who were anything but put together that we wanted to be a place where it's okay to not be okay and to be a church where unchurched people would really like to be a part of it, which meant we're going after a different market than most churches, right? And so when people would come up and complain about stuff that we either did or didn't do compared to what they knew other churches did or didn't do, we would just take them back to the vision. A vision that galvanized our church around a passion that gave us distinction. And through the years, trust me, I have had endless opportunities to fill in the gaps. I've had endless opportunities to talk about our theology. But folks, the church has precious few chances to get the attention of what I call the drive-by crowd. People who never give us anything but just the briefest of notice. They never give us their undivided attention. But maybe if we have a float in a parade to say thank you to the vets, or if we give our car buffs a place to strut their stuff in our prime parking spots, and if our statement about who we are is memorable and enticing and filled with love, maybe, just maybe, if something in their lives at some point is missing or broken or bruised, maybe that vision will stick just enough that one Sunday they'll sneak in the back door to hear just a little more. Now, Nehemiah packs his vision, and he unpacks it in three phases. And if you've been sitting on a vision for what you believe God is calling you to do, I want you to take good notes right now, because I believe there is, in verse 17, a God-given outline for how you can unpack your vision to the people in your world. It's taken right out of verse 17. I think it's beyond brilliant. So let's read the verse again, and as I do, I want to point out three things. Look for these. First, Nehemiah defined the problem that his vision was intending to fix. Second, he offered a solution. And third, he described the urgency. The verse says, "Then I said to them, 'You see the trouble we're in? Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire.'" That is defining the problem. Keep reading. "So, come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem." What's that? That's the solution he's offering. "And if we do that, we will no longer be in disgrace." That's describing the urgency. So Nehemiah begins by defining the problem. A fairly obvious problem. The walls were broken down. Now I want you to watch, because Nehemiah begins verbalizing what everybody already knew. He says, "You see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins." And the people answered and said, "Stranger, you're rude. Who do you think you are? Persian dude comes into our town, starts poking fun at our sorry little wall. We know it's sorry. What's up with that?" Just understand, most of the people listening to Nehemiah had never known a time when Jerusalem did have a wall. Instead, all day, every day, for over 100 years, they had passed in and out of those burned down gates their whole lives. They didn't need some stranger from Persia coming to tell them their gates were burned down. Let me ask you something. How would you feel if a house guest went around poking out every flaw in your home? Broken lamps, cracked tile, chipped baseboard, outdated furnishings. Chances are good you'd want to punch his lights out, right? After all, this is my house. And buddy, I know better than you what needs tended to. But then after your house guest leaves, what happens? His comments linger. Until, before you know it, you're prancing over to Ace Hardware. Not because you weren't aware that stuff needed fixing, but because you suddenly saw those months-old problems through somebody else's eyes. That's Jerusalem. These people had grown so accustomed to the fact that the walls were torn down, they didn't even notice anymore. They weren't even concerned anymore. They had just learned to live with it. The inconveniences, the dangers, it was just their lifestyle. And as the years passed, they lost sight of what could be and what probably should be, and nobody seemed able to remember how it used to be. So Nehemiah's remarks were a wake-up call. Come on, people, things are bad. There's trouble here in River City. And with his words came a fresh new perspective. And as soon as they saw their city, as Nehemiah saw their city, they caught the vision for what had to be. Casting a great vision will always include at least a little bit of jolting people out of their apathy. Vision casters seldom bring new information. They simply bring an impassioned concern for a troublesome problem, a fresh set of eyes. And they often boil a complex problem down to a contemporary take on that old proverb. Remember the little kid in the fairy tale who said, "Oh, the emperor has no clothes." And if the vision caster is effective, his audience will typically say, "You're right. We gotta do something." Can I tell you a few somethings I think we need to respond to? People, our culture is no longer the ally of the church. There was a time when church, school, and state locked arms and we stood together as strong, tall walls in defense of what is right and what is true and what is noble. But those guardrails now lie in ruins. And as a result, most of our neighbors, our friends, and our co-workers are largely convinced that the church no longer holds any measurable value in their lives. Primarily because the church, in their view, typically only cares about ourselves, unless, of course, we get the chance to jump in and judge somebody or condemn somebody who is different and clearly not as good as me. And the greatest loss caused by this new social construct is what one leader has called the graying of the American church. And don't tell me you haven't noticed. And believers, if we don't do something to change that reality, even if the change we affect is only here in this little corner that God has given us oversight over, according to Dr. George Carey, the American church is just one generation away from extinction. I don't know about you, but that frightens me. But I got to tell you, I do not want the death of the church that Jesus died for. The church where I came to be saved. I don't want that church. It must not, and if I have anything to say about it, it will not ever happen. Not this church, not on my watch. But Nehemiah didn't stop, having just unpacked this disheartening problem. Nehemiah 2 offered a solution, pretty straightforward solution. He said, come, let us rebuild the wall. Now, in case you're wondering what my solution is to the problem I just unpacked for us, well, if it's true, and I believe it clearly is, that today's church is losing today's rising generation, what must we do in response? I believe, people, we got to create irresistible environments for the unchurched adults and their families in our community. Way more than just having buildings where churched people gather and sit in churchy places so we can do churchy things. We need to design, build, and then gift back to the unchurched in our communities a space that is designed with their needs in mind. A safe, non-judgmental space where they can come and feel welcomed and find many of their felt needs met for their benefit with no strings attached. The church needs to be as she once was and as she was designed originally by God to be, an irresistible environment of magnetic love, joy, and community engagement that unchurched people are just magnetically drawn to be here to the point they can't not come here because they love it when they are here. I've been reading an awful lot recently about what many church experts consider to be the key to 21st century evangelism in America. You know what it is? One word. Hospitality. Understand, this generation will no longer gather in droves to attend a stadium crusade. They're not going to pull alongside the sidewalk where a street preacher has his materials and he's prepared to preach. So how do we then interact with people who need Jesus concerning the one thing that matters most in this world? I think we got to offer them a fun, safe place where the whole family feels welcomed and can come. Something they might not experience in any other way. And then maybe, if we love on people, then maybe when something happens in that family's life, a family that has felt warmly loved and accepted here, maybe nowhere else, but they did here, when something in their world gets broken or winds up missing or feels frighteningly, even overwhelmingly new and unknown, when something happens that causes them to actually seek the hope-filled, eternally proven solutions that we know the gospel alone can provide, maybe they will see in our ministry the one that welcomed them without any strings. Maybe they will see us as their hope-filled church of first choice. Maybe. Nehemiah's audience was in total agreement with the problem. The walls were down and they knew it. They also agreed with the solution that the wall needed to be rebuilt. And even though it took an outsider to tell them these things, they were instantly motivated to fix what was wrong. Nehemiah had envisioned a walled city, and that vision ignited the people into action. And not only did they sign up to get the work done, the work was done, as we're going to see in a few weeks, in less than 60 days. Our solution, I'm kind of thinking, will take a little longer than that. But I believe we need to rebuild the walls. I do. Not so we can safely crouch in here in our defensive, little protective posture, but so that we can create a warm, welcoming, safe place that is irresistibly marked by incredible love, great hospitality, and boundless joy. I'll have more to say about that in the weeks to come, but for now, let's move to the third part of Nehemiah's vision, because he defined the problem and how he was going to fix it. That was the solution. It was one so obvious, and yet it ignited the people to act. But then third, he described the urgency, and it was clearly this: let's do this so we will no longer be in disgrace. Part one described what had gone wrong. Part two talked of how they could get out. Part three presented the reason why it needed to be done and why it needed to be done now. In every vision plan, you've got to ask and answer those two questions. Number one, why must we do this? Number two, why must we do this now? And Nehemiah's reason for building the wall was wrapped in a deeply theological reality. I don't have time to build into the significance of those seven words. Just understand the great city of Jerusalem had been built by the people of God to reflect the glory and greatness of God. And so as long as the holy city of Jerusalem lay in ruins, it reflected poorly on their God. And that's why something had to be done. One of the problems with unpacking a big vision is that visions are rarely either new or unique. Like Nehemiah, we see the things around us that really need to be changed, and we kind of wonder, why hasn't somebody done it already? I mean, it's not like I'm that smart, and I'm the first one to see the problem. But see, what others have also seen, they were content to ignore, but the leader, the one called by God, not only sees the problem, he takes the appropriate action. He points out a solution and then offers a compelling reason why something has to be done. And people, we got to do it now. Here's Nehemiah stepping through the debris of a wall that had been down for over 100 years. So you got to know there were people going, what's the hurry? I mean, why rebuild now? What's changed all of a sudden? Just one thing from what I see in the text. A leader came along. He saw a huge problem, conceived a solution, and perceived far greater danger in sticking with the status quo than sticking his neck out to do what he knew had to get done. In that same way, I perceived that the 21st century church, folks, we are facing a dire, eternally desperate problem. And as the pastor of this church in this age for this time, I believe we need to act. We made a big move about 4 years ago to this storefront. And it was a move that was a really big upgrade from the church in a box thing we were doing, because at least now we had a building 24/7. That's pretty cool. But here's the thing. Our storefront faces our community's backside. Okay, there's probably a better way of putting that. But you get the point? We're invisible. Now, we've done some pretty incredible ministry in an invisible place. But that irresistible environment that I am sensing God is leading us to provide, we've just never had the opportunity to do it. The resources to do the dream the way I believed God would want us to do that dream. So why now? Why is it so important now? Why not 5 years from now? What makes this season a moment of truth for us? Well, I could give 100 reasons, but here's one. Church, we got to stop being content with doing the same things the same way with the same tools, even as we expect wildly different results. And my heart, for one, it desperately longs for more results. See, I believe the time is short. Anybody else? That the end is near. And even if I'm wrong about that, my dad was wrong about that. It's not going to be that long before this old guy dies. I am going to die. And I hate to break it to you, you're going to die too. And because a very long time ago I gave my heart to Jesus Christ, when I do die, I'm going to be ushered right into the throne room of heaven. And I'm going to see my Jesus face to face. Not because I deserve it, but because through His blood, somehow He made me worthy. And when I get to that great room, my God's going to show me how many people in my life said, "I love you, Jesus." And how many kept their arms folded and walked away. And I'm going to feel that burden very deeply, because I believe with all that is in me that God put me here on this planet. The reason I breathe is so I can take as many people with me to heaven as I possibly can. It's why the angels breathe, to help nudge people just like you and me in the direction of the most significant person our world has ever known. And so if in the time we've got, if you and I don't do everything we can do, if we just shrug our shoulders in the hopes that maybe the next generation will do what we have been called and positioned and prospered to do, the legacy of our time here will read a very sad ending. So what's the urgency? Forget about me. You don't know how long you got either. But even more, you don't know when our Savior is going to return. See, all we do know is that with every tick of the clock, the day of His appearing is drawing closer. Let's take as many people to heaven as we can, while we can. You with me? Let's pray. We're going to enjoy together the fruit of the meal of Jesus. It's going to be passed after I pray. Just worship with us. Lord, Father, I thank You that You've called us not only to be saved, You've called us to be agents of change in our world. To not only cast a vision for what could be, but to help pave the way so that someone who may not know You now may, at whatever point in the future, no matter what the end landscape of that story might look like, that they might embrace Jesus while there's time. And I pray that now, Lord, and I just thank You for this season of worship in the name of Jesus.